whiskey would have made him feel sentimental about it. Call merely sat on the hill, studying the cattle. It was clear to Augustus that he was not troubled in any way by leaving the border or the town. "It's odd I partnered with a man like you, Call," Augustus said. "If we was to meet now instead of when we did, I doubt we'd have two words to say to one another." "I wish it could happen, then, if it would hold you to two words," Call said. Though everything seemed peaceful, he had an odd, confused feeling at the thought of what they had undertaken. He had quickly convinced himself it was necessary, this drive. Fighting the Indians had been necessary. If Texas was to be settled, protecting the border was necessary, else the Mexicans would have taken South Texas back. A cattle drive, for all its difficulty, wasn't so imperative. He didn't feel the old sense of adventure, though perhaps it would come once they got beyond the settled country. Augustus, who could almost read his mind, almost read it as they were stopped on the little knob of a hill. "I hope this is hard enough for you, Carl," he said. "I hope it makes you happy. If it don't, I give up. Driving all these skinny cattle all the way is a funny way to maintain an interest in life, if you ask me."
"Well, I didn't," Carl said.
"No, but then you seldom ask," Augustus said. "You should have died in the line of duty, Woodrow. You know how to do that fine. The problem is you don't know how to live."
"Whereas you do," Call asked.
"Most certainly," Augustus said. "I've lived about 100 to your one. I'll be a little riled if I end up being the one to die in the line of duty, because this ain't my duty and it ain't yours either. This is just fortune hunting."
"Well, we wasn't finding one in Lonesome Dove," Call said. He saw Dietz returning from the northwest, ready to lead them to the bed ground. Call was glad to see him. He was tired of Gus and his talk. He spurred the mare on off the hill. It was only when he met Dietz that he realized Augustus hadn't followed. He was still sitting on old Malaria, back on the little hill, watching the sunset and the cattle herd.
Part 2 Chapter 26
July Johnson had been raised not to complain, so he didn't complain. But the truth of the matter was, it had been the hardest year of his life, a year in which so many things went wrong that it was hard to know which trouble to pay attention to at any given time. His deputy, Roscoe Brown, 48 years of age to July's 24, assured him cheerfully that the increase in trouble was something he had better get used to.
"Yep. Now that you've turned 24, you can expect no mercy," Roscoe said.
"I don't expect no mercy," July said. "I just wish things would go wrong one at a time. That way, I believe I could handle it."
"Well, you shouldn't have gotten married then," Roscoe said.
It struck July as an odd comment. He and Roscoe were sitting in front of what passed for a jail in Fort Smith. It just had one cell, and the lock on that didn't work. When it was necessary to jail someone, they had to wrap a chain around the bars.
"I don't see what that has to do with it," July said.
"Anyway, how would you know? You ain't never been married."
"No, but I got eyes," Roscoe said. "I can see what goes on around me. You went and got married, and the next thing you know, you turned yellow. Makes me glad I stayed a bachelor. You're still yellow," he went on to point out.
"It ain't Elmira's fault that I got jaundice," July said. "I caught it in Missouri at that darn trial." It was true that he was still fairly yellow and fairly weak, and Elmira was losing patience with both states. "I wish you'd turn back white," she had said that morning, although he was noticeably less jaundiced than he had been 2 weeks before. Elmira was short, skinny, brunette, and had little patience. They had only been married 4 months, and one of the surprises, from July's point of view, was her impatience. She wanted the chores done immediately, whereas he had always proceeded at a methodical pace. The first time she bawled him out about his slowness was only 2 days after the wedding. Now it seemed she had lost whatever respect she had ever had for him. Once in a while, it occurred to him that she had never had any anyway. But if that was so, why'd she marry him? "Uh-oh, here comes Peach," Roscoe said. "Ben must have been a lunatic to marry that woman." "According to you, all us Johnsons are lunatics," July said, a little irritated. It was not Roscoe's place to criticize his dead brother, though it was perfectly true that Peach was not his favorite sister-in-law. He had never known why Ben nicknamed her Peach, for she was large and quarrelsome and did not resemble a peach in any way. Peach was picking her way across the main street of Fort Smith, which was less of a quagmire than usual, since it had been dry lately. She was carrying a red rooster for some reason. She was the largest woman in town, nearly 6 feet tall, whereas Ben had been the runt of the Johnson family. Also, Peach talked a blue streak, and Ben had seldom uttered 3 words a week, although he had been the mayor of the town. Now, Peach still talked a blue streak, and Ben was dead. That fact, well known to everyone in Fort Smith for the last 6 weeks, was no doubt what Peach was coming to take up with him. "Hello, July," Peach said. The rooster flapped a few times, but she shook him and quieted him down. July tipped his hat, as did Roscoe. "Where'd you find the rooster?" Roscoe asked. "It's my rooster, but he won't stay home," Peach said. "I found him down by the store. Skunks will get him if he ain't careful." "Well, if he ain't careful, he deserves it," Roscoe said. Peach had always found Roscoe an irritating fellow, not as respectful as he might be. He was little better than a criminal himself, in her view, and she was opposed to his being deputy sheriff, although it was true that there was not much to choose from in Fort Smith. "When are you aiming to start after that murderer?" she asked July. "Why, pretty soon," he said, although he felt tired at the thought of starting after anybody. "Well, he'll get over to Mexico or somewhere if you sit around here much longer," Pete said. "I expect to find him down around San Antonio," July said. "I believe he has friends there." Roscoe had to snort at that remark. "That's right," he said. "Two of the most famous Texas Rangers that ever lived. That's his friends." "July will be lucky not to get hung himself, if you ask me. Jake Spoon ain't worth it." "It's nothing to do with what he's worth," Peach said. "Ben was the one who was worth it. He was my husband and July's brother and the mayor of this town. Who else do you think seen to it your salary got paid?" "The salary I get don't take much seeing to," Roscoe said. "A darn midget could see to it." At $30 a month, he considered himself grievously underpaid. "Well, if you was earning it, that man wouldn't have got away in the first place," Peach continued. "You could have shot him down, which would have been more than he deserved." Roscoe was uneasily aware that he was held culpable in some quarters for Jake's escape. The truth was, the killing had confused him, for he had been a good deal fonder of Jake than of Ben. Also, it was a shock and a surprise to find Ben lying in the street with a big hole in him. Everyone else had been surprised, too. Peach herself had fainted. Half the people in the saloon seemed to think the mule skinner had shot Ben. And by the time Roscoe got their story sorted out, Jake was long gone. Of course, it had been mostly an accident, but Peach didn't see it that way. She wanted nothing less than to see Jake hang, and probably would have if Jake had not had the good sense to leave. July had heard it all 25 or 30 times, the versions differing a good deal depending upon the teller. He felt derelict for not having made a stronger effort to run Jake out of town before he himself left for the trial in Missouri. Of course, it would have been convenient if Roscoe had promptly arrested the man, but Roscoe never arrested anybody except old man Darton, the one drunk in the county Roscoe felt he could handle. July had no doubt that he could find Jake Spoon and bring him back for trial. Gamblers eventually showed up in a town somewhere and could always be found. If he hadn't had the attack of jaundice, he could have gone right after him, but now 6 weeks had passed, which would mean a longer trip. The problem was Elmira didn't want him to go. She considered it an insult that he would even consider it. The fact that Peach didn't like her and had snubbed her repeatedly didn't help matters.
Elmira pointed out that the shooting had been an accident, and made it plain that she thought he ought to not let Peach Johnson bully him into making a long trip. While July was waiting for Peach to leave, the rooster, annoyed at being held so tightly, gave Peach's hand a couple of hard pecks. Without an instant's hesitation, Peach grabbed him by the head, swung him a few times, and wrung his neck. His body flew off a few feet and lay jerking. Peach pitched the head over in some weeds by the jailhouse porch. She had not got a drop of blood on her. The blood was pumping out of the headless rooster into the dust of the street. "That'll teach him to peck me," Peach said. "At least I'll get to eat him instead of a skunk having the pleasure." She went over and picked the rooster up by the feet and held him out from her body until he quit jerking. "Well, July," she said, "I hope you won't wait too long to start. Just because you're a little yellow don't mean you can't ride a horse." "You Johnsons marry the darndest women," Roscoe said, when Peach was safely out of hearing. "What's that?" July said, looking at Roscoe sternly. He would not have his deputy criticizing his wife. Roscoe regretted his quick words. July was touchy on the subject of his new wife. It was probably because she was several years older and had been married before. In Fort Smith, it was generally considered that she had made a fool of July, though since she was from Kansas, no one knew much about her past. "Why, I was talking about Ben and Sylvester," Roscoe said. "I guess I forgot you're a Johnson, since you're the sheriff." The remark made no sense. Roscoe's remarks often made no sense, but July had too much on his mind to worry about it. It seemed he was faced every single day with decisions that were hard to make. Sometimes, sitting at his own table, it was hard to decide whether to talk to Elmira or not. It was not hard to tell when Elmira was displeased, though. Her mouth got tight, and she could look right through him and give no indication that she even saw him. The problem was trying to figure out what she was displeased about. Several times he'd tried asking if anything was wrong and had been given bitter, vehement lectures on his shortcomings. The lectures were embarrassing because they were delivered in the presence of Elmira's son, now his stepson, a 12-year-old boy named Joe Boot. Elmira had been married in Missouri to a fellow named D. Boot, about whom she had never talked much. She just said he died of smallpox. Elmira also often lectured Joe as freely as she lectured July. One result was that he and Joe had become allies and good friends. Both of them spent much of their time just trying to avoid Elmira's wrath. Little Joe spent so much time around the jail that he became a kind of second deputy. Like Elmira, he was skinny, with big eyes that bulged a little in his thin face. Roscoe was fond of the boy, too. Often he and Joe went down to the river to fish for catfish. Sometimes, if they made a good catch, July would bring Roscoe home for supper, but those occasions were seldom successful. Elmira thought little of Roscoe Brown, and though Roscoe was as nice to her as he could be, the fish suppers were silent, tense affairs. "Well, July, I guess you're between a rock and a hard place," Roscoe said. "You either got to go off and fight them Texas Rangers, or else stay here and fight Peach." "I could send you after him," July said. "You're the one that let him get away." Of course he was only teasing. Roscoe could hardly handle old man Darton, who was nearly 80. He wouldn't stand much of a chance against Jake Spoon and his friends. Roscoe almost tipped over in his chair, he was so astonished. The notion that he might be sent on a job like that was ridiculous. Living with Elmira must have made July go crazy if he was thinking such thoughts. "Peach ain't gonna let it rest," July said, as much to himself as to Roscoe. "Yes, it's your duty to catch the man," Roscoe said, anxious to get himself as far off the hook as possible. "Benny was your brother, even if he was a dentist." July didn't say it, but the fact that Benny had been his brother had little to do with his decision to go after Jake Spoon. Benny had been the oldest, and he himself the youngest, of the 10 Johnson boys. All but the two of them went away after they grew up, and Benny seemed to feel that July should have gone away, too. He was reluctant to give July the sheriff's job when it came open, although there had been no other candidate than Roscoe.
July got the job, but Benny remained resentful and had balked at even providing a new lock for the jail's one cell. In fact, Benny had never done one kind thing for him that July could remember. Once, when he pulled a bad tooth of July's, he had charged the full fee. July's feelings of responsibility had to do with the town, not the man who was killed. Since pinning on the sheriff's badge 2 years before, his sense of responsibility for the town had grown steadily. It seemed to him that as sheriff he had a lot more to do with the safety and well-being of the citizens than Benny had as mayor. The rivermen were the biggest problem. They were always drinking and fighting and cutting one another up. Several times he had had to pile 5 or 6 into the little cell. Lately, more and more cowboys passed through the town. Once, the wild men of Shanghai Pierce had come through, nearly destroying 2 saloons. They were not bad men, just rowdy and wild to see a town. They tended to scare people's livestock and rope their pets, and were intolerant of any efforts to curb their play. They were not gunmen, but they could box. July had been forced to crack 1 or 2 of them on the jaw and keep them in jail overnight. Little Joe worshipped the cowboys. It was plain to July that he would run off with one of the outfits given the chance. When not doing chores, he would spend hours practicing with an old rope he had found, roping stumps or sometimes the milk pen calf. July was prepared to accept a certain rowdiness on the part of the cowboys as they passed through, but he felt no leniency at all for men like Jake Spoon. Gamblers offended him, and he had warned several out of town. Roscoe loved to whittle better than any man July had ever known. If he was sitting down, which was usually the case, he was seldom without a whittling stick in his hands. He never whittled them into anything, just whittled them away, and the habit had come to irritate July. "I guess if I leave, you'll whittle up the whole darn town before I get back," he said. Roscoe held his peace. He could tell July was in a touchy mood, and who could blame him? With a wife like Elmira and a sister-in-law like Peach. He enjoyed his whittling, but of course he was not going to whittle down any houses. July often exaggerated when he was in a bad mood. July stood up. He wasn't very tall, but he was sturdy. Roscoe had once seen him lift an anvil down at the blacksmith shop, and he had just been a boy then. "I'm going home," July said. "Well, send little Joe over if he ain't busy," Roscoe said. "We'll play some dominoes." "It's milking time," July said. "He's got the milk. Anyway, Ellie don't like him playing dominoes with you. She thinks it'll make him lazy." "Why, it ain't made me lazy. And I've played dominoes all my life," Roscoe said. July knew the statement was absurd. Roscoe was only a deputy because he was lazy. But if there was one thing he didn't want to get into, it was an argument over whether Roscoe was lazy, so he gave him a wave and walked on off.
Chapter 27
When July got home, it was nearly dusk. Home was just a cabin on the edge of town. As he passed the horse pen, he saw that little Joe had roped the milk pen calf again. It was easy to do, for the calf seldom moved. "You've got that calf broke," July said. "You could probably saddle him and ride him if you wanted to." "I milked," Joe said. He got the pail, and the two walked to the cabin together. It was a fairly good cabin, although it didn't yet have a wood floor, just well-packed dirt. July felt bad about bringing his bride to a cabin without a wood floor, but being sheriff didn't pay much, and it was the best he could do. It was a high cabin with a little sleeping loft in it. July had initially supposed that that was where they would put the boy, but in fact Elmira had put them in the sleeping loft and assigned the boy to a pallet on the floor. When they got there, she had already cooked the supper, just bacon and cornbread, and was sitting up in the loft with her feet dangling. She liked to sit and let her feet dangle down into the cabin. Elmira liked being alone and spent most of her time in the loft, occasionally doing a little sewing. "Don't you slosh that milk," she said, when Joe came in with a pail. "Ain't much to slosh," Joe said. It was true. The milk cow was playing out. Joe put his rope over by his pallet. It was his most prized possession. He had found it in the street one morning after some cowboys had passed through. He didn't dare use it for several days, assuming the cowboy who had lost it would come back and look for it, but none did. So gradually he began to practice on the milk pan calf. If he had had a horse, he would have thought seriously of leaving and trying to get on with a cow outfit, but they only had two horses, and July needed both of those. "The food's on," Elmira said, but she made no move to come down from the loft and eat it with him. She seldom did eat with them. It bothered July a good deal, though he made no complaint. Since their little table was almost under the loft, he could look up and see Elmira's bare legs as he ate. It didn't seem normal to him. His mother had died when he was six, yet he could remember that she always ate with the family. She would never have sat with her legs dangling practically over her husband's head. He had been at supper at many cabins in his life, but in none of them had the wife sat in the loft while the meal was eaten. It was a thing out of the ordinary, and July didn't like for things to be out of the ordinary in his life. It seemed to him it was better to do as other people did. If society at large did things a certain way, it had to be for a good reason. And he looked upon common practices as rules that should be obeyed. After all, his job was to see that the common practices were honored, that citizens weren't shot or banks robbed. He had arrested plenty of people who misbehaved, yet he could not bring himself to say a word to his wife about her own unusual behavior. Joe didn't share July's discomfort with the fact that his mother seldom came to the table. When she did come, it was usually to scold him, and he got scolded enough as it was. Besides, he liked eating with July, or doing anything else with July. So far as he was concerned, marrying July was the best thing his mother had ever done. She scolded July as freely as she scolded him, which didn't seem right to Joe. But then July accepted it and never scolded back, so perhaps that was the way of the world. Women scolded, and men kept quiet and stayed out of the way as much as possible. "Want some buttermilk?" July asked, going to the crock. "No, sir," Joe said. He hated buttermilk, but July loved it so that he always asked anyway. "You ask him that every night," Elmira said from the edge of the loft. It irritated her that July came home and did exactly the same things day after day. "Stop asking him," she said sharply. "Let him get his own buttermilk if he wants any. It's been 4 months now, and he ain't drunk a drop. Looks like you'd let it go." She spoke with a heat that surprised July. Elmira could get angry about almost anything, it seemed. Why would it matter if he invited the boy to have a drink of buttermilk? All he had to do was say no, which he had. "Well, it's good," he said quietly. Joe almost wished he had taken a glass, since it would have kept July out of trouble, but it was too late. After that one remark, the meal went smoothly, mainly because no one said another word. Joe and July ate their cornbread and bacon, and Elmira hung her feet in the air. "You take that medicine," she said to July as soon as he had finished. "If you don't, I guess you'll be yellow the rest of your life." "He ain't as yellow as he was," Joe said, feeling that it was incumbent on him to take up for July a little bit, since July would never take up for himself. He had no real fear of his mother. She whipped him plenty, but her anger never lasted long, and if she was really mad, he could always outrun her. "He's too yellow for me," Elmira said. "If I'd wanted a yellow husband, I'd have married a Chinaman." "What's a Chinaman?" Joe asked. "Go get a bucket of water," Elmira said. July sat at the table, feeling a little sad, while the boy drew a bucket of water. At least they had a well. The river was nearly a mile away, which would have been a long carry. Joe brought the bucket in and went back outside. It was stuffy in the small cabin. There were a lot of fireflies out. For amusement, he caught a few and let them flicker in his hand. "Want a bath?" July asked his wife. "I'll fetch some more water if you do." Elmira didn't answer because she didn't really hear him. It was peculiar. But July almost never said anything that she did hear anymore. It seemed to her that the last thing she heard were their marriage vows. After that, though she heard his voice, she didn't really hear his words. Certainly he was nothing like D. Boot when it came to conversation. Dee could talk all week and never say the same thing twice, whereas it seemed to her July had never said anything different since they'd married. That in itself didn't bother her, though. If there was one thing she didn't need to do, it was talk to a man. "I've been thinking I might better go on and catch Jake Spoon," July said. He said everything in the same tone of voice, making it doubly difficult to pay attention to him, but Elmira caught his meaning. "Do what?" she asked. "Go get Jake Spoon," July said. "I'm over my jaundice enough to ride." "Let him go," Elmira said. "Who wants him anyway?" July was not about to tell her Peach wanted him. "Well, he killed Benny," he said. "I say let him go," Elmira said. "It was an accident." She came downstairs and dipped her face in the cool water, then wiped it on an old piece of sacking they used for a towel. "He shouldn't have run," July said. "He might have got off." "No, Peach would have shot him," Elmira said. "She's the one don't care about the law." That was a possibility. Peach had an uncontrollable temper. "Well, I've got to catch him. It's my job," he said. Elmira felt like laughing. July was flattering himself if he thought that he could catch a man like Jake Spoon. But then, if she laughed, she would be giving herself away. July had no idea that she knew Jake Spoon, but she had known Jake even before she knew Dee. He and Dee had been buddies up in Kansas. Jake even asked her to marry him once, in a joking way, for Jake was not the marrying kind, and she hadn't been then either. He had always kidded her, in the days when she was a sporting girl in Dodge, that she would end up respectable, though even he couldn't have guessed that she'd marry a sheriff. It amused him no end when he found out. She had seen him twice in the street after he came to Fort Smith, and she could tell by the way he grinned and tipped his hat to her that he thought it was one of the world's finest jokes. If he had ever come to the cabin and seen that it had a dirt floor, he would have realized it was one of those jokes that aren't funny. And yet she had not hesitated when July proposed, though she had only known him 3 days. It was the buffalo hunters who convinced her that she had better change her way of life. One had taken a fancy to her, a man so big and rough that she feared to refuse him, though she should have. In all her days she had never been used so hard, and the buffalo hunters were numerous. Had it not been for Dee, they might have finished her, but Dee had always been partial to her and loaned her enough money to make a start in a town where she had no reputation, St. Joe, Missouri, which was where July came to testify. She met him in court, for she had had no job at the time and was watching the trial to pass the hours. She just had a dusty little room in the boarding house in St. Joe, and the boy a cubbyhole in the attic. Dee snuck in twice in the dead of night, so as not to tarnish her reputation. He liked Joe, too, and had the notion that he ought to grow up to be something. It was the last time she saw Dee that they had worked out the smallpox story. "I'm going north, Ellie. I'm tired of sweating," he said. "You go south, and you'll be fine. If anybody asks, say your husband died of smallpox. You can get to be a widow without ever having been married. I might get the smallpox anyway, unless I'm lucky." "I'd go north with you, Dee," she said quietly, not putting much weight on it. Dee didn't care to have much weight put on things. But Dee just grinned and pulled at his little blonde mustache. "Nope," he said. "You got to go respectable. I bet you make a school marm yet." He had given her a sweet kiss, told her to look after his boy, and left her with $10 in the memory of their reckless years together in Abilene and Dodge. She had known he wouldn't take her north. Dee traveled alone. It was only when he settled in a town to gamble that he liked a woman, but he had offered to go shoot the buffalo hunter who had used her so hard. She had pretended she didn't know the man's name. Dee wasn't a hard man, certainly not as hard as the buffalo hunter. He would have been the one to end up dead. As for July, it had been no trick to marry him. He was like some of the young cowboys who had never touched a woman or even spoken to one. In 2 days, he was hers. She soon knew that he made no impression on her. His habits never varied. He did the same things in the same way every day. 9 days out of 10, he even forgot to wipe the buttermilk off his upper lip. But he wasn't hard like the buffalo hunters. With him, she was safe from that kind of treatment, at least. When she heard that Jake was in town, she thought she might just run away with him, though she knew he was even less dependable than Dee. But once he shot Benny, she had to give up that little dream, the only little dream she had. Since then, life had been very boring. She spent most of her days sitting in the loft, letting her feet dangle, remembering the old days with Dee and Jake. July was sitting in the dark, buttermilk on his lip, looking at her as patiently as if he were a calf. The very look of him, so patient, made her want to torment him any way she could. July knew that for some reason he irritated Elmira. She reacted crossly to almost everything he said or suggested. Sometimes he wondered if all men only made their wives look hostile and sullen. If it wasn't the case, then he wondered what made the difference. He had always taken pains to be as nice as possible, sharing all the chores with little Joe and sparing her inconveniences whenever he could. Yet it seemed the more polite he tried to be, the more he stumbled or said the wrong thing or generally upset her. At night it had gotten so he could hardly put a hand on her. She looked at him so coldly. She could lie a foot from him and make him feel that he was miles away. It all made him feel terrible, for he had come to love her more than anything. "Wipe your lip, July," she said. "I wished you'd ever learn, or else stop drinking that buttermilk." Embarrassed, he wiped it. When Elmira was annoyed, she had made him so nervous that he couldn't really remember whether he had eaten or what. "You ain't sick, are you?" he asked. There were fevers going around, and if she had one, it would explain why she felt so testy. "I ain't sick," she said. Since he had started the business about Jake, he thought he might as well finish it. She was mad anyway. "If I start after Jake's spoon now, I expect I could be back in a month," he said. Ellie just looked at him. It was all right with her if he was gone for a year. The only reason she objected to his going was that she knew Peach was behind it. If somebody was going to tell the man what to do, it ought to be her and not Peach. "Take Joe with you," she said. Such a thought had never occurred to July, though it had crossed his mind that he might take Roscoe. "Why, you'll need him," July said. "You got the chores." Elmira shrugged. "I can milk that old cow," she said. "The chores ain't hard. We ain't raising cotton, you know. I want you to take Joe. He needs to see the world." It was true, the boy might be useful on a long trip. There would be someone to help him watch the prisoner, once there was a prisoner. But it meant leaving Ellie alone, which he didn't like. As if reading his mind, she sat down at the table and looked at him. "I've been alone before, July," she said. "It ain't gonna hurt me. Roscoe can help me if I need something I can't carry." That was true, of course, not that Roscoe could be particularly obliging about it. Roscoe claimed to have a bad back and would complain for days if forced to do anything resembling manual labor. "There could be a fight," July said, remembering that Jake Spoon was said to have difficult friends. "I don't expect it, but you never know with a gambler." "I don't reckon they'd shoot a boy," Elmira said. "You take Joe. He's got to grow up sometime." Then, to escape the stuffy cabin, she went outside and sat on a stump for a while. The night was thick with fireflies. In a little while, she heard July come out. He didn't say anything. He just sat. Despite his politeness and constant kindness, Elmira felt a bitterness toward him. The thing he didn't know was that she was with child. He wouldn't know it either if she could help it. She had just married out of fright. She didn't want him or the child either, and yet she was scared to try and stop the child. In Abilene, she had known a girl who had bled to death from trying to stop a baby. She had died on the stairs outside Elmira's room on a bitter cold night. Blood had run all the way down the stairs and frozen in the night into red ice. The girl, whose name was Jenny, had stuck to the stairs. They had had to heat water in order to get her loose. The sight had been enough to discourage her from trying to stop a baby, yet the thought that she had one made her bitter. She didn't want to go through it all again. She didn't want to live with July Johnson. It was just that the buffalo hunter had been so rough, it had scared her into thinking she had to find a different life. Life in Fort Smith was different, too, so dull that she found little reason to raise herself from her quilts most days. The women of the town, though they had no reason to suspect her, suspected her anyway and let her alone. Often she was tempted just to walk into a saloon where there was a girl or two she might have talked to, but instead she had given way to apathy, spending whole days sitting on the edge of her sleeping loft doing nothing. Watching the fireflies sparkle in the woods behind the cabin, Elmira waited, listening. Sure enough, in a few minutes she heard the little metallic clicks as July slowly rotated the chambers in his pistol before going back to town to make his rounds. It set her teeth on edge that he would do it every night. "Guess I'll go have a look," he said. "Won't be long." It was what he said every night. It was true, too. Unless the rivermen were fighting, he was never long. Mainly, he hoped that when he came to bed, she'd want him. But she didn't want him. She had kept him at a distance since she was sure about the baby. It hurt his feelings, but she didn't care. As she heard him walk off through the darkness, her spirits sank even lower. It seemed there was no winning in life. She wanted July and Joe to be gone, suddenly, so she would not have to deal with them every day. Their needs were modest enough, but she no longer wanted to face them. She had reached a point where doing anything for anyone was a strain. It was like heavy work. It was so hard. It came to her more strongly every day how much she missed D. Boot. He was the exact opposite of July Johnson. July could be predicted down to the least gesture, whereas Dee was always doing what a person least expected. Once in Abilene to get revenge on a madam he hadn't liked, he had pretended to bring her a nice pie from the bakery, and indeed he had got the baker to produce what looked like a perfect pie crust. But he had gone over to the livery stable and filled the pie crust with fresh horse turds. The madam, a big, mean woman named Sal, had actually cut into it before she sensed the joke. Elmira smiled to herself, remembering some of the funny things Dee did. They had known one another for nearly 15 years, since she had found herself stranded as a girl way up in Kansas. It hadn't been all Dee, of course. There had been plenty of others. Some had only lasted a few minutes, some a week or two or a month, but somehow she and Dee always found themselves back together. It irritated her that he had been content to just pull his mustache and head for the north without her. He seemed to think that it would be easy for her to be respectable. Of course, it was her fault for picking July. She hadn't expected his politeness to irritate her so much. After the night deepened, the moon came out and rose above the pines. Elmira sat on the stump and watched it, glad to be alone. The thought that July and Joe would be going off caused her spirits to lift. It occurred to her that once they left, there would be nothing to stop her from leaving, too. Boats went up the Arkansas nearly every week. It might be that Dee Boot was missing her as much as she was missing him. He wouldn't mind that she was with child. Such things he took lightly. It made her smile to think of finding Dee. While July tracked one gambler, she would track another, in the opposite direction. When July got back, with or without Jake, and discovered that his wife was gone, it might surprise him so much he would even forget to drink his buttermilk.
Chapter 28.
The next morning, an hour before dawn, July and Joe left the cabin and caught their horses. Joe was almost stunned with excitement at getting to go with July. His friend Roscoe Brown had been stunned, too, when July went by the jail and told Roscoe they were going. "You'll get that boy killed before I even teach him all my domino tricks," Roscoe said. It puzzled him that July would do such a thing.
Joe was not tempted to question the miracle. The main thing that bothered him was that he lacked a saddle, but July took care of that by borrowing an old single tree from Peach Johnson. She was so pleased July was finally going after her husband's killer that she would have given them the saddle. Rats had eaten most of it anyway. Elmira got up and cooked them breakfast, but the food did nothing to ease the heaviness of heart which July felt. All night he had hoped she might turn to him, it being his last night at home for a while, but she hadn't. Once he had accidentally touched her, turning on the pallet they slept on, and she had stiffened. It was clear to July that she wasn't going to miss him, though he was certainly going to miss her. It was peculiar, but she showed no sign of being sorry to see Joe go either. Yet Joe was her son, and he was her husband. If she didn't love her husband and her son, who did she love? For all she knew, they would be gone for months, and yet she was just as brisk with them as if it were an ordinary day. She saw to it that Joe drew another bucket of water before he left, and then jumped on July for nearly forgetting his jaundice medicine. Yet for all her bad temper, it was no relief to leave. He felt apprehension so strongly that at one point it seemed to tighten his throat and nearly caused him to choke on a bite of cornbread. He felt he was being carried along through his life as a river might carry a chip. There seemed to be no way he could stop anything that was happening, although it all felt wrong. The only relief he could find was in the knowledge that he was doing his job and earning the $30 a month the town paid him. There were a few tight-fisted citizens who didn't think that there was $30 worth of sheriffing to do in Fort Smith in a given month. Going after a man who had killed the mayor was the kind of work people seemed to think a sheriff ought to do, although it would probably be less dangerous than having to stop two rivermen from carving one another up with knives. They left Elmira standing in the door of the cabin and rode through the dark town to the jail. But before they got there, Red, Joe's horse, suddenly bowed up and began to buck and threw him. Joe was not hurt, but he was dreadfully embarrassed to be thrown right at the outset of such an important trip. "It's just Red," July said. "He's got to have his buck. He's gotten rid of me a time or two that way." Roscoe slept on a couch in the jail and was up and stumbling around in his bare feet when they got there. July got a rifle and two boxes of bullets, and then got down a shotgun, too. "Well, that's my shotgun," Roscoe said. He was not in the best of tempers. He hated to have his sleeping quarters invaded before it was even light. "We'll need to eat," July said. "Joe can shoot a rabbit now and then if we don't see no deer." "You'll probably see a Comanche Indian, and they'll cook both of you as if you were darn rabbits," Roscoe said. "Oh, they're about whipped, I reckon," July said. "'Bout," Roscoe said. "Well, I about knocked out a wasp nest last year, but the two I missed near stung me to death. 'Bout ain't good enough where Comanches are concerned. You must be planning to make San Antonio in one day, since you're starting this early," he added, still grumpy from having been routed out of bed. July let him grumble and took a saddle scabbard off one of the other rifles so there'd be something to put the shotgun in. By the time light had begun to show over the river, they were ready to go. Roscoe was awake enough by then to feel apprehensive. Being deputy was an easy job while July was around, but the minute he left, it became heavy with responsibility. Anything could happen, and he would be the one who would have to handle it. "Well, I hope the darn Comanches don't decide they want Fort Smith," he said morosely. Several times he had had dreams of a troop of wild Indians riding right down the street and filling him full of arrows while he sat in front of the jail whittling. "They won't," July said, anxious to get away before Roscoe thought up other bad things that might happen. Roscoe noted that Joe was bareheaded, another sign of July's recklessness. It occurred to him that he had an old black felt hat. It was hanging on a peg, and he went back in and got it for the boy. "Here, you take this," he said, surprised at his own generosity. When Joe put it on, his head disappeared nearly down to his mouth, which was grinning. "If he wears that, he'll probably ride off a cliff," July said.
although it was true the boy needed a hat. "Oh, he can tie it on with some string," Roscoe said. "It'll keep that darn sun out of his eyes." Now that they were ready, July felt strangely unwilling to leave. It was getting good light. Far down the street they could see the river shining, and beyond it a faint glow of red on the horizon. In its awakening hour the town seemed peaceful, lovely, calm. A rooster began to crow. Yet July had a sense that something was terribly wrong. More than once it had occurred to him that Elmira might have some strange disease that caused her to act the way she was acting. She had less appetite than most people, for one thing. She just nibbled at her food. Now he had no one to trust her to except Roscoe Brown. He was only slightly less afraid of her than he would be of a Comanche. "You look after Ellie," he said sternly. "If she needs her groceries carried, you carry them." "Okay, July," Roscoe said. July got on his horse and adjusted his bedroll and sat looking at the river. They weren't carrying much bedding, but then the warm weather was coming. "Take her a fish now and then if you catch one," he said. To Roscoe Brown it seemed a strange instruction. Elmira had made it plain that she didn't like fish. "Okay, July," he said again, though he didn't mean to waste his time offering fish to a woman who didn't like them. July could think of no more instructions. Roscoe knew the town as well as he did. "Joe, now you be careful," Roscoe said. For some reason, it affected him to see the young boy going. It was a poor saddle he had, too. But the boy still grinned out from under the old hat. "We'll catch him," Joe said proudly. "Well, I'll try not to let nobody shoot no more Dennis," Roscoe said. July regarded this remark as irrelevant, for Roscoe knew well enough that the town had been without a Dennis since Benny's death. "Just watch old man Darton," he said. "We don't want him to fall off the ferry." The old man lived in a shack on the north bank and merely came over for liquor. Once in a while he eluded Roscoe, and twice already he had fallen into the river. The ferryman didn't like him anyway, and if it happened again, they might well let him drown. "I'll handle the old scamp," Roscoe said confidently. Old man Darton was one responsibility he felt he could handle any day. "Well, I guess I'll see you when I see you, Roscoe," July said. Then he turned his horse away from the river and the glowing sky, and he and Little Joe were soon out of town.
Chapter 29
6 days later, responsibility descended upon Roscoe Brown with a weight far beyond anything he had ever felt. As usual, it fell out of the clear blue sky, as fine a day as one could want, with the Arkansas River sparkling down at the end of the street. Roscoe, having no pressing duties, was sitting in front of the jail whittling when he noticed Peach Johnson was coming up the street with little Charlie Barnes at her side. Charlie was a banker, and the only man in town to wear a necktie every day. He was also the main deacon in the church, and, by common consent, the man most likely to marry Peach if she ever remarried. Charlie was a widower, and richer by far than Benny had ever been. Nobody liked him, not even Peach, but she was too practical a woman to let that stop her if she took a notion to marry. When Roscoe saw them coming, he snapped shut his whittling knife and put the stick he had been whittling in his shirt pocket. There was no law against whittling, but he didn't want to get a reputation as an idler, particularly not with a man who was as apt as not to end up the next mayor of Fort Smith. "Morning, folks," he said when the two walked up. "Roscoe, I thought July gave you instructions to look after Elmira," Peach said. "Well, he said take her a fish if I caught one, but I ain't caught any lately," Roscoe said. He felt a little guilty without even knowing what was wrong, for Elmira had not once crossed his mind since July left. "Well, if I know July, and I do know July, I bet he said more than that," Peach said. "Well, he said to carry her some groceries if she asked, but she ain't asked," he said. "When have you seen her?" Charlie Barnes asked. He was looking stern, though it was hard for a man so short and fat to really muster such sternness. The question stumped Roscoe. Probably he had seen Elmira recently, but when he thought about it, he couldn't think when. The woman was not much for traipsing around town. Right after the marriage, she had been seen in the store some, spending July's money, but he couldn't recollect having seen her in a store in recent days.
"Well, you know Elmira," he said. "She don't come out much. Mainly she just stays in the cabin."
"Well, she ain't in it now," Pete said.
"We think she's gone," Charlie Barnes said.
"Why? Where would she go?" Roscoe said.
Peach and Charlie didn't answer, and a silence fell.
"Maybe she just took a walk," Roscoe said, although he knew that sounded weak.
"That's what I thought yesterday," Peach said. "She wasn't there yesterday, and she ain't there today. I doubt she'd take no overnight walk."
Roscoe had to admit it was unlikely. The nearest town, Catfish Grove, was 14 miles away, and not much of a destination at that.
"Maybe she just don't want to answer the door," he said. "She takes lots of naps."
"Nope. I went in and looked," Peach said. "There ain't a soul in that cabin, and there wasn't yesterday, neither."
"We think she's gone," Charlie Barnes said again. He was not a talkative man.
Roscoe got up from his comfortable seat. If Elmira was indeed gone, that constituted a serious problem. Peach and Charlie stood there as if they expected him to do something, or tell them right off where she had gone.
"I wonder if something got her," he asked, thinking out loud. There were still plenty of bears in the woods, and some said that there were panthers, though he himself had never seen one.
"If she wandered off, anything could have got her," Peach said. "Could have been an animal, or it could have been a man."
"Why, Peach, I don't know why a man would want her," Roscoe said,
only to realize that the remark probably sounded funny. After all, Peach was related to her.
"I don't either, but I ain't a man," Peach said, giving Charlie Barnes a hard look.
Roscoe thought it unlikely that Charlie wanted Elmira. It might be that he didn't even want Peach.
He walked to the edge of the porch and looked up the street, hoping to see Elmira standing in it. In all his years as a deputy, he had never heard of a woman just getting lost, and it seemed unfair that it should happen to July's wife. There was nobody in the street but a farmer with a mule team.
"Why, I'll go have a look," he said.
"Maybe she just went visiting."
"Who would she visit?" Peach asked.
"She ain't been out of that cabin more than twice since July married her. She don't know the names of 5 people in this town. I was just going to take her some dumplings, since July has gone off. If I hadn't done it, I doubt she would have ever been missed."
From her tone, Roscoe got the clear implication that he had been remiss in his duty. In fact, he had meant to look in on Elmira at some point, but the time had passed so quickly he had forgotten to.
"Well, I'll go right up there," he said, trying to sound cheerful. "I expect she'll turn up."
"We think she's gone," Charlie Barnes said for the third time. Roscoe decided to go at once to keep from having to hear Charlie Barnes repeat himself all morning. He tipped his hat to Peach and started for the cabin, but to his dismay, Peach and Charlie stayed right at his heels. It disturbed him to have company, but there was nothing he could do about it. It seemed to him curious that Peach would take Elmira dumplings, for the 2 women were known not to get along. It crossed his mind that Elmira had seen Peach coming and gone into hiding. Sure enough, the cabin was empty. There was no sign that anybody had been in it for a day or two. A slab of cornbread sat on the cook stove, already pretty well nibbled by the mice.
"She mostly sat in the loft," Roscoe said, mainly to hear himself talk. Hearing himself was better than hearing Peach.
"There ain't nothing up there but a pallet," Peach said. That proved to be the truth. It was not much of a pallet, either, just a couple of quilts. July, being the youngest of the Johnson family, had never had any money and had not accumulated much in the way of goods. Roscoe racked his brain to try and think if there was anything missing, but he had never been in the loft before and could not think of a possession that might have been missing, just Elmira. "Didn't she have shoes on when they got hitched?" he asked. Peach looked disgusted. "Of course she had shoes on," she said. "She wasn't that crazy." "Well, I don't see no shoes in this cabin, men's or women's," Roscoe said. "If she's gone, I guess she wore 'em." They went out and walked around the cabin. Roscoe was hoping to find a trail, but there were weeds all around the cabin, wet with dew, and all he did was get his pants legs wet. He was growing more and more uneasy. If Elmira was just in hiding from Peach, he wished she'd give up and come out. If July came back and found his new wife missing, there was no telling how upset he'd be. It seemed to him the most likely explanation was bears, though he knew it wasn't a foolproof explanation. If a bear had just walked in and got her, there would have been some blood on the floor. On the other hand, no bear had ever walked into Fort Smith and got a woman, though one had entered a cabin near Catfish Grove and carried off a baby. "I guess a bear got her, unless she's hiding," he said unhappily. Being a deputy sheriff had suddenly gotten a lot harder. "We think she's gone," Charlie Barnes said with an irritating persistence. "If a bear had got her, of course she would be gone." "He means we think she's left," Peach said. That made no sense at all, since the woman had just married July. "Left to go where?" he said. "Left to do what?" "Roscoe, you ain't got the sense God gave a turkey," Peach said, abandoning her good manners. "If she left, she just left. My guess is she got tired of living with July." That was such a radical thought that merely trying to think it gave Roscoe the beginnings of a headache. "My God, Peach," he said, feeling stunned. "There's no need to swear, Roscoe," Peach said. "We all seen it coming. July's a fool or he wouldn't have married her." "It could have been a bear, though," Roscoe said. All of a sudden, it seemed the lesser of two evils. If Elmira was dead, July might eventually get over it. If she had run off, there was no telling what he might do. "Well, where's the tracks, then?" Peach asked. "If a bear came around, all the dogs in this town would have barked, and half of the horses would have run away. If you ask me, Elmira's the one that run away." "My God," Roscoe said again. He knew he was going to get blamed no matter what. "I bet she took that whiskey boat," Peach said. In fact, a boat had headed upriver only a day or two after July left. It was the only logical explanation. No stage had passed through in the last week. A troop of soldiers had come through, going west, but soldiers wouldn't have taken Elmira. The boat had been filled with whiskey traders, headed up for Bent's Fort. Roscoe had seen a couple of the boatmen staggering on the street, and when the boat had left with no fights reported, he had felt relieved. Whiskey traders were rough men, certainly not the sort married women ought to be traveling with. "You better go see what you can find out, Roscoe," Peach said. "If she's run off, July's going to want to know about it." That was certainly true. July doted on Elmira. It took no more than a walk to the river to confirm what Peach had suspected. Old Sabin, the ferryman, had seen a woman get on the whiskey boat the morning it left. "My God! Why didn't you tell me?" Roscoe asked. Old Sabin just shrugged. It was none of his business who got on boats other than his own. "I figured it was a whore," he said. Roscoe walked slowly back to the jail, feeling extremely confused. He wanted badly for it all to be a mistake. On the way up the street, he looked in every store, hoping he would find Elmira in one of them, spending money like a normal woman, but she wasn't there. At the saloon, he asked Renfro, the barkeep, if he knew of a whore who had left town lately, but there were only two whores in town, and Renfro said they were both upstairs asleep. It was just the worst luck. He had worried considerably about the various bad things that might happen while July was gone, but the loss of Elmira had not been among his worries. Men's wives didn't usually leave on a whiskey barge. He had heard of cases in which they didn't like wedded life and went back to their families, but Elmira hadn't even had a family, and there was no reason for her not to like wedded life, since July had not worked her hard at all. Once it was plain that she was gone, Roscoe felt in the worst quandary of his life.
July was gone, too. Off in the general direction of San Antonio. It might be a month before he got back, at which point someone would have to tell him the bad news. Roscoe didn't want to be the someone, but then